Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today in the studio is Anchorage pediatrician Dr. Roz Singleton. Dr. Singleton is a staff physician with the Division of Public Health Section of Epidemiology with the state of Alaska. She's also worked as a pediatrician with the Native Health Consortium. And also on the program, but joining us by telephone from Seattle, is Dr. Janet Englund. Dr. Englund is a pediatric infectious disease specialist, and she works at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. Our topic today is childhood immunizations. What we'd like to discuss primarily is the risks and benefits, and also perhaps a little bit of time about what's new and what's important to understand about childhood immunizations. Over the next hour or so, if you have questions that come up, you have comments, you want to ask some experts about what we really know and feel like is the best information, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Roz, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's the first time you've been here in my 15 years. And Dr. Englund, thanks very much for taking the time to join us from Seattle. If you don't mind, let's one of you, I think, Janet, you wanted to do this. Dr. Englund, tell us a little bit about the basic way immunizations work. Why do we give them in the first place? How do they help protect us? What's the mechanism by which that happens?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for inviting me to talk about vaccines, which is one of my most favorite topics there is. I think vaccines are really pretty simple to understand, and in fact, they are developed by scientists, but based on a really simple fact that most mothers already know. Once your child or once you have had a certain type of infectious disease, it turns out that you are protected from getting it again. Nearly always. Not always, but nearly always. And examples of this, of course would be measles or chickenpox or diphtheria or tetanus, diseases some of which we don't see anymore because we now have a way of giving a shot with just a very small portion of the bacteria that causes the disease that's been inactivated with a little bit of a chemical so that, in fact, you aren't giving the entire germ to the person. You're giving just a small portion that creates an immune response producing antibodies, which are small little molecules that can fight an infection, can trigger the immune system to fight the infection itself. So, in fact, a shot is not giving the disease. It's giving a very, very small, one millionth of a part of the organism that causes the disease, and protecting the person from ever getting that disease. Maybe not forever. For some diseases, it's forever. For some diseases, it might only be for 10 years or 20 years or some certain amount of time.
All right. And the next question, well, there are times that any pediatrician or any physician has heard, well, I got the vaccine, but I still got the illness, or this is the second, third, and fourth time, particularly with chickenpox, that I've heard. What are some of the explanations of why that may happen? Our immune system, in my mind, is very exquisitely successful at doing what it is. So I'm often, when I hear the answer, the point that I've got it more than once, I think, really, they've had similar illnesses, but not exactly the same one. Can you help people understand why they may think they've had the same illness a couple of times?
Oh, I think you're right. I think many diseases kind of look alike. For example, chickenpox can look like another enterovirus disease called hand, foot, and mouth disease. And the difference is the chickenpox kind of starts at the top of your head and moves out to your feet and hands, and enterovirus starts at your hand and feet and kind of moves in. It actually looks a little bit different, but if you don't really know, it can look the same.
Right.
Now, there are a few cases where the vaccine doesn't work so well, and we do know that you can get two cases of chickenpox, for example, if you get your first case when you're less than 6 months of age. Mm-hmm. And the reason that that happens is that you still have protective antibody left over from the mother, that these young babies have protective antibody. So, in fact, they're protected. Usually their disease is pretty mild, and because it's so mild, they often are naive, and they can get it again when they're three or four or go back to school.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really good about our immune system is that nature kind of protects our offspring by allowing some of the protection that mother has developed over her whole life to cross the placenta and protect babies for 6 or 9 months. And that works very well, but it also messes up sometimes what we're trying to do with immunizations or natural illnesses that have happened during that period of time. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yep, that's right.
All right. So the history of immunizations is very, very long. If you get back and really start looking into it, it's maybe even into antiquity in some parts of the world. But let me ask both of you, what are the things that you think about when I think about the important historical aspects, both good and bad, about immunizations? Roz?
Well, the 1700s, when Jenner founded the smallpox vaccine and coined the term vaccination. Although if you look back in antiquity, there are many instances where cultures, including India and other countries, actually had a process where they inoculated a tiny portion of smallpox virus. Mm-hmm. So that's a big event. Polio in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s created a fear among my parents' generation, and I, as a small girl, along with everyone in my age group and children around the United States, were taken in to big facilities. In our case, it was actually the county fair, and we were inoculated against polio at that time. And whereas there'd been over 20,000 cases of paralytic polio in those years before, there were within a few years there were 61 cases, and now no cases of polio for a couple of decades. So that's a big event that I remember.
And I think, Roz, what you've brought up is when parents can see what the disease does, when parents are living in the fear of, for example, polio or measles, when people have seen their kids get paralyzed forever from polio and they want to have a big event to protect them, the response from the community has been astronomically good because people really understand that they don't want their kids to get infected. I think there's issues now that people don't really know what polio is, or they've never seen it, or they don't believe it's even a real disease anymore, which
right.
It is.
Right. And there's a great Nova TV presentation just recently called Calling the Shots, and they brought up instances around the world where we're seeing resurgence of vaccine-preventable disease in Europe and in the United States and in other countries. And the real source is people have not seen these diseases for a generation, and they no longer have that big concern about their child getting measles. Measles is probably one of the biggest examples. In 2011, there were 13,000 cases of measles and several deaths in France. Now, how could that happen when a couple years before they'd had 68 cases? And what had happened was that measles is extremely contagious. You don't even have to be in the same room with someone to get measles. And their measles vaccination rate fell below 90%. And they had a couple instances of measles that just spread wildly in the country. Unfortunately, in the United States, we're starting to see measles resurge just this year.
Let me take just a second, if you both don't mind. Let me remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection, originating from KSKA Anchorage, Alaska. We're talking today with Dr. Rod Singleton, a staff physician with the State Department of Health in the Section of Epidemiology, and Janet Engelen, who is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Washington in Seattle Children's Hospital. If you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Jan, let me come back to this immunology a little bit and ask you to help people understand how come it is then that if we have a lot of immunized people and we slowly are not seeing, or we're not seeing as much of that illness as we did before, and people slowly begin not to be immunized, why it comes back? Why do these illnesses return? What's the mechanism, or what do we need to understand about how that works?
Well, I think this is actually pretty well understood, and it has to do with how many susceptible people there are in a population. That is, how many people are vulnerable or who are able to get the disease. So if you have a population where 95% of people are immunized, and you can just imagine there's five people, one in five different elementary schools, so if someone comes into the elementary school, they can only infect and make sick one kid in each school, for example. Just think if you have a disease such as measles where only 50% of kids are immunized. In each school, that means then that 50% of kids are not immunized. And if one person comes into the school and comes there with a low-grade fever, which is how measles starts. Measles doesn't start with spots. Measles starts with just a little bit of a fever, and sometimes a runny nose. Then you could infect a lot of kids who could then go on and infect more kids and more kids and more kids. The same thing can be seen for other infections, such as a disease called meningococcal meningitis. In crowded situations, in colleges, in crowded situations such as camps or work camps or even in the Army, close contact of vulnerable people can lead to a very big outbreak.
So this is where that term that people may have heard of called herd immunity comes from, and where public health individuals are trying to keep our herd immunity up so that if a single or a small number of cases enters a population, there can be very little chance for spread.
That's correct. And in fact, the scientists have studied that, and they know exactly, not exactly, but we know approximately what percentage of people need to be immunized to protect oneself against different diseases. Now, that works for diseases such as measles or flu or chickenpox or diseases that are spread by coughing and respiratory disease. It actually does not work that way for tetanus.
Mm-hmm.
Tetanus is a disease where if you step on a rusty nail or get yourself cut on barbed wire, it doesn't matter if everybody else is immunized and you're not, and you're the one that steps on that rusty nail, you're in trouble.
Another aspect of this need for large groups of people being protected is, I think that the normal population doesn't understand that one of the reasons viruses are so successful, one reason is that they're very contagious, or they're being shed before a person may look sick often, and then they may continue to be shed after they're well. But that's this idea that you're shedding virus and contagious to others before you know you're sick makes it very difficult to avoid others mm-hmm. who are already ill. Jan, you're the infectious disease expert. I don't want to say things that are not true, but let me ask you if that is also a big factor in this.
Oh, I think that's a huge factor. That is a big factor for chickenpox, which we still have, although it's getting less, but we still have in the schools, is that kids will go to chickenpox. Kids with coming down with chickenpox will go to school for a day or two before they get spots and are obviously infected with chickenpox. And during that time, they're actually much more contagious than the time period when they have the spots on their bodies. So these diseases are much more spreadable and contagious before you come down with the identifying symptoms.
Another issue that I just can't help but bring in the new enterovirus 68, the respiratory problem is causing such a lot of problem in the lower 48, which fortunately I'm not aware that I've seen. But what I read from the experts in this is that this particular virus may be continue to be spread and be contagious for a long period of time after the illness is apparently began to wane, which also is a problem because how long are you going to exclude people from school with not knowing for sure whether they're still contagious or not?
Well, I think that's true. The enterovirus that we see, and we have this ongoing here in Seattle, and we have a lot of suspected cases in our hospital. But the bottom line is, you don't know. No one knows exactly when a person is contagious from this virus. Yeah. But we have done studies, published studies that show that these type of viruses can be shed in kids for up to 10 weeks. So nobody's going to isolate anyone for 10 weeks, especially because they have very, very little symptoms at the end. So, in fact, then we go back to our tried and true method of good hand washing and don't kiss on the lips and don't cough in the face, mm-hmm. which is kind of old-fashioned, but, you know, it does help.
All right, so let me back. I was going to say, so we're seeing a resurgence of these diseases. Well, let me beg the question. Are we seeing a resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases and the consequent deaths and mortality or deaths and morbidity illness due to these potentially avoidable problems? Is that true? And then if it's true, why is that the case?
I'll make a quick stab, and then Jan can add. I think certainly for measles, this year, 2014, there's been over 600 reported cases of measles in the United States. That's the most measles cases since we eliminated measles in 2000. 83% of the people who are getting measles are completely unvaccinated. And all the cases are linked to imports of people traveling back from other countries or traveling from other countries. And then measles is being spread in pockets where there's low levels of immunization. And that's really the reason why we're seeing measles come back this year in the United States at a rate that we haven't seen for over a decade.
All right, so we're definitely beginning to see an increasing number of cases of measles from a time where there was no transmission within the United States.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we know that vaccine rates to measles have decreased correspondingly during that period of time.
What we know is that measles is occurring where there are pockets of under-immunized people.
Where the herd immunity is not good.
Exactly. Okay. One of the best example is an Amish group went to the Philippines on a medical mission, and they returned, and they were not vaccinated against measles. And when they returned, they carried measles back with them because there's thousands and thousands of cases of measles in the Philippines. And since there was very poor immunization coverage in that community, measles spread quite rapidly, and there were secondary cases of measles. That means someone passing it on to another person for a couple generations. And that has been one case out of about 21 outbreaks from most of the, those are all from the Philippines, in addition to additional outbreaks from other countries.
Janet, other vaccine-preventable diseases that appear to have been much, much better controlled until recently, and it seems like they're coming back at a time when vaccine coverage rates are decreasing in our country. Are there other illnesses that you would think we should talk about?
Sure. I think perhaps one of the best examples is pertussis, which Alaska has one of the highest pertussis rates, and Roz can talk a little bit more. It's probably not a good thing to be famous for. pertussis is coming back, and I would just like to say that people think that pertussis, or whooping cough, just causes a coughing disease. And that's just not true. We've had a vaccine since 1948. It's been pretty effective. We've had a change in vaccines about 15 years ago, and we now actually immunize teenagers or adolescents against pertussis because we're so afraid of giving pertussis to young babies. Young babies die from pertussis. And no one really understands that, perhaps, except for some of the doctors working in the medical center. So, I mean, I've taken care of three babies who've died of pertussis in the past several years. This is horrible. This is not why I went into medicine. Taking care of pertussis that could be totally prevented. These kids, these little babies, are getting pertussis from their brothers or sisters or their mothers or fathers. They're getting it from family members because you can't immunize a two-week-old baby against pertussis. You need to immunize the family members. So there's been a very big resurgence, most recently in California and along the West Coast, of pertussis causing very serious disease, mortality, and serious complications in some of the survivors.
Yeah, pertussis is an unusual organism. It's difficult, as I understand it. Its ability to generate an immune response in humans is not particularly great. So this is a very, even though it's a tragic and I would agree, it seems to me a preventable problem. It's much more complex issue. The vaccine that, as I understand, Jan, you and Roz butt in here if I'm saying something wrong, but we had a vaccine that was pretty doggone effective, but it had a significant number of side effects, particularly high fever, maybe seizures related to it and so forth. Nothing terribly bad, but the public didn't like that. The health officials didn't like it, so we changed vaccines, and the vaccine that we're now using is much less likely to cause side effects, but it turns out the duration of immunity wanes faster than we thought it would. So now we've got a bunch of people who got this newer vaccine and are outgrowing that immunity, making them susceptible, which confounds this whole problem. Is that right? A good explanation of the complexity, part of the complexity of this particular problem?
I would just like to say that's part of the complexity, but in most of these fatal cases in infants, that is not the case.
Okay.
In most of the infant cases, there is a complete lack of immunization. There's a lack of immunization in the family members.
Right.
I'm talking about the newborn cases.
Right, right.
The siblings in my state have not been immunized. And, in fact, there now is recommendation for the mother to become immunized with pertussis vaccine, and that hasn't happened.
Even when she's pregnant?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we
right.
recommend pertussis right. vaccine for pregnant women now.
Which
because
seems
of
safe
the
enough.
Problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Is there any evidence that the resurgence of pertussis is slowing down, and that gets back to the natural history of pertussis, which could wax and wane over time, so it can be difficult to really tell how we're doing. What's the answer to that question? Are we getting better at preventing these deaths?
In Alaska, we did have a resurgence in 2012-13, which was waning in 2013. However, we have seen an increase in cases just in the last month. So I would say in Alaska, it's certainly not over.
Another illness that I would like to just maybe ask Jan if you've seen a case. I think I heard that you have, and I've seen a case of tetanus in training. I'm long enough, old enough that I saw someone have tetanus. It's not an illness that almost anybody, very few people have ever seen tetanus, and that's part of the initial vaccine series. That is a very nasty illness, at least in my experience in kids, that is maybe worth talking about and a reason to also be immunized. Jan, what have you seen cases of tetanus?
Well, I certainly have seen actually lots of cases of tetanus, but that's because I've worked around the world.
Okay.
For example, in the Philippines, there's lots of neonatal tetanus. They have wards for babies that are born with tetanus. In Africa, where I worked, where they didn't have wards and we didn't have ventilators, that's where babies would die of tetanus. And we have had suspected cases, probable cases here in Seattle. Yeah. what I find interesting about this in the cases that we see in the United States are often 2 or 3 years old because they get really good care. I mean, they're born in a hospital or a home situation where it's sterile, so they don't have to really worry about the things that we see in Africa or Asia where they're born with potentially rusty needles cutting the cord. But what we're seeing in the United States is this complete absence of immunization because parents are concerned or afraid, or they read perhaps an inflammatory website. And so we're seeing a lot of children in our schools, you know, 12, 14, 16 years old that have never had any shots whatsoever. And that is very concerning because they are susceptible to tetanus. And it's very difficult to make up all those shots if and when they want to go to a public college that often requires them.
All right. We are already close to halfway through the program. It runs very quickly when we get into a program that's, I think, so interesting. So I have to take my mandatory break here. I want to remind all our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we're going to continue our discussion on childhood immunizations with Dr. Roz Singleton of Anchorage and pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. Janet Englund, who's joining us by telephone from Seattle. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing childhood immunizations, particularly the risks and benefits. If we have time, we'll talk about some new developments. Our guests are Anchorage pediatrician and staff physician with the Division of Public Health Section of Epidemiology for the state of Alaska, Dr. Roz Singleton. And she's in the studio with me and joining me by telephone from Seattle is Dr. Janet Englund. She is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, if you want to call in the next 30 minutes or so, is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And the usual proviso, if you're listening between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, you're listening to a tape broadcast and we will not be able to answer your questions. However, you can always go to our archive at alaskapublic.org and find the Line 1 archives and listen to the program or refer someone to listen to that program. We keep the archives open for a long time if you want to go back and listen to some program that you've missed or would like to listen to again. And before I continue, I did promise to do a brief promo for the Alaska Urologic Institute. They're doing their yearly free prostate screenings this today, September 15th, 16th, 18th, and 19th, as well as the 20th. They're in the evenings for the most part. If you're interested, the number to call is 771-3837. That's the free prostate screenings with the Alaska Urological Institute here in Anchorage, 771-3837. I have an email that came in, and the listener says, I think I saw this on a recent PBS documentary. There was a bad batch of polio vaccine that went out in the 50s, causing hundreds to get polio. He, in parentheses, he thinks that was the result. And all polio vaccinations were halted, but thousands of people volunteered to have their kids participate in new testing since they knew the benefits were so much greater than the possible harm, even after such a tragic incident. What either one of y'all want to comment on that? There's a couple of issues there. There's the fact that there's always risk and there's always benefit, and then there's been some bad things that have happened potentially with vaccines in the past that we hope we've learned from. So comments. Janet, you want to say anything about that?
Sure. I think this was a well-known event. There's actually at least one book, and there's two books that I know written about it. It's called The Cutter Incident, C-U-T-T-E-R, The Cutter Incident. And Paul Offit has written one book, and there's another book online. So it was part of the rush to mass produce the live polio vaccine, in which the live polio vaccine was not fully inactivated, and there were several hundred children who were impacted by this unfortunate event. But the one good thing that came out of this was actually the fact that from this point onward, vaccines were regulated by the FDA, by the Food and Drug Administration. I think it was a terrible event to have happen, but with the climate of the government back then, there was just no desire to interfere with some of the companies, and this event and public opinion forced the government to take an active role so that now all vaccines undergo much more strict regulation, testing, and licensure by the federal government.
And a good example of that is the initial rotavirus vaccine, which was tested in several thousand children before it was licensed in the 1990s. However, post-licensing surveillance, which is quite active process, picked up a small signal of an increase in intussusception, which is when the bowel comes in on itself, telescopes in on itself. The CDC and other agencies did an immediate evaluation and further studies that identified increased risk in about 1 in 10,000 children, and that vaccine was taken off the market in a very short time and replaced almost 10 years later with newer vaccines that have, and those vaccines were studied in 70,000 children, Rotatect, one of the vaccines. So that just highlights the extreme scrutiny over vaccines, which is very important.
All right, we have a caller. Rachel, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm wondering if there is any information out there that isn't such a... I feel like when I look for immunizations, I have a 1.5-year-old, it's the CDC recommendations are just kind of a one-size-fits-all, no matter what the risk factors or... Mm-hmm. lifestyles, and
right.
I was very surprised when I had my child that the hospital was recommending things like Hep C for a brand new baby, and I'd had my other child 11 years ago and didn't think it was the case then, so I hesitate to give her so many shots that they recommend when it seems like they're not relevant.
Right. So one correction before I give it to our guest, it's hepatitis B. There's no hepatitis C vaccine. Available. And it is recommended, and we can ask one of them why it might be recommended in right after a birth when a baby would appear to have very little risk of acquiring it. So who wants to address this issue?
I'll talk just about why hepatitis B is recommended in newborns, and then Dr. Englund can follow up. Hepatitis B is a particular issue for Alaska. Before hepatitis B vaccine in the 1980s, Alaska natives had the highest rate of hepatitis B of any ethnic group in the U.S. And hepatitis B is a liver infection that often is unrecognized. However, it can lead to liver cancer and chronic hepatitis B and cirrhosis. The highest risk of developing chronic hepatitis B is in newborns who get hepatitis B from their mother. Although there's a recommendation to screen all newborns, the most effective way to prevent hepatitis B is a shot in the newborn period of hepatitis B, which is highly effective, and then also screening the mothers. And since the hepatitis B vaccine in Alaska, Alaska natives now have the lowest hepatitis B rate of any population in the U.S. And whereas in the past we actually saw liver cancer occurring in young men and women, we now have not seen any hepatitis hepatocellular cancer from hepatitis B for many, many years. So it's a very important vaccine for preventing long-term complications. And Jan, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I do. I think that perhaps we don't do a good job of explaining it right. Well, to parents. But in fact, I was living in Chicago when we moved it from the newborn period to the two-month period, and we did it because of a whole bunch of reasons, one of it being money, which has a lot to do with it, and reimbursement. And during that time, several cases of newborn hepatitis was missed, and those kids went on to have chronic hepatitis B, which gives you a huge chance. I can't give you the exact percentage, but it's a huge chance of having very severe liver problems that leads to either death or a liver transplant. So it really is a problem, and giving it in the newborn period is really a good way of addressing that, because the tests that we test mothers with are not 100% perfect for several reasons, which I can talk to. But the second issue was wanting different websites, and I think it's really hard to be telling people which websites to go to. I personally do like the CDC website, but then I'm a medical person. I just want to say that there's one of my colleagues who writes really fun books and has actually discovered and invented a couple vaccines. His name is Paul Offit, O-F-F-I-T-T, and he's one of these people that puts his money where his mouth is. You know, he actually has started a website, and it is a rational website. I don't think it's biased particularly one way or another, but he has invented one vaccine, of which he's invented a rotavirus vaccine. But the website is at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I'm looking at it right now. And if you just go on to Google and write down Children's Hospital of Philadelphia vaccine, it gets you to the Vaccine Education Center, and they have a mobile app and all kinds of apps that actually you can look at every single vaccine and schedule, and it gives you data about the different vaccines and the rationale. And it's not written for doctors. It's written for both parents and healthcare professionals.
Right. So Rachel's point. Rachel, are you still on the air?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is a common one for a pediatrician like myself in private practices is I'm the mom. I've been tested. I know I don't have hepatitis B. In fact, I've got immunization for hepatitis B. My baby's born. Somebody wants to give them a vaccine for hepatitis B. And what I'm hearing, and so it's difficult to understand mm-hmm. that. And I what I'm hearing you all say is there's no test that's perfect. Things happen. I asked Brian mm-hmm. McMahon, one of the world's experts on mm-hmm. hepatitis B, the same question. He said, well, it's also in the environment, and it can be transmitted from inanimate objects. It was part of his explanation. Mm-hmm. I remember asking him mm-hmm. specifically about this. But there's also this difference between individual risk and public health. And mm-hmm. that's another issue here, in that we're trying to get kids, a huge cohort of kids growing up that are all immunized against. And so we can really decrease the transmission, which gets back to the native situation. So there's a large number of a lot of research, a lot of issues that have gone into making these individual decisions on when to do it, but it still can be very difficult mm-hmm. for a mother with a newborn in that situation to understand why we're doing that.
Yeah, and you also asked a very good question about why so many vaccines so early, and the good news is that actually the number of antigens or proteins in vaccines has decreased over the years. And there's combinations of vaccines so that there's fewer number of shots. So that's good news for parents, but it is overwhelming to see the number of diseases prevented and try to just understand all the information about vaccines, even though there's vaccine information statements. Just a brief note about, you know, why do we start at 2 months with vaccines for diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and for Haemophilus influenza, meningitis, and for pneumococcal disease and polio. And the reason for starting at 2 months is because some of these infections can occur very, very early in life. And as Dr. Englund discussed, pertussis or whooping cough really is fatal in the first 3 months of life. So you want to try to protect infants as early as possible. And the same case is for Haemophilus influenza meningitis or Hib meningitis, something a lot of parents don't recognize, but pediatricians, especially those like myself who practiced in the 1980s, were very well aware of the devastating effects of Hib meningitis. That was the most common form of meningitis.
That help, Rachel?
Thank you very much.
Yep. All right. Thanks for your call. One thing I'd also just mention before I take another call or another email is that I think the public is also unaware of how much thought and even the public's input on making decisions about which vaccines. I was recently wrote a short little piece, and I got looking into how all the decisions are made and who makes them and how often these people get together to make these decisions. But I don't think people are aware of all the effort that goes in. And there is public input into making these decisions where they But once you really kind of get all the information and understand it, then it really does begin to make sense. Paul Offit's books, his website, which is also linked on our website, does give you a very good and a more comprehensive bit of information than we can do in this short period of time about all each of the vaccines and why they're recommended. Mm-hmm. Another caller, an email, I should say, says, well, let's say you're about 62 years old and have had all your vaccines in the past. Which ones do you need a regular booster for as you get older? We're all pediatricians here. What's the answer for you guys?
Great question. You need your tetanus and diphtheria booster. And if you haven't had a TDAP, that's the tetanus booster also with pertussis, then you need one dose of that. And at age 65, you're recommended to receive the pneumococcal vaccine to prevent pneumococcal disease, which is a big cause of pneumonia in elders. And last of all, you should get a yearly flu vaccine, even though immunity decreases as people get older, but there's a new high-dose flu vaccine that has increased immunity in older adults. So those are three that I'd recommend, and as well as the zoster or shingles vaccine.
Another question. This is an email. It says, I was listening to you discuss measles. Obviously, I'm very concerned about measles, and we'll be vaccinating my five-month-old for it and getting all of his other vaccines. But, and the rest of this sentence is underlined, but it is also seems like that the MMR vaccine is one that is discussed as having the most adverse reactions. Can you discuss whether these are scientifically documented reactions or anecdotes from the anti-vax movement? And if so, how common are they? So this lady is asking, what's the real story on risk-benefit for MMRs?
So, Roz, I can step in a little bit here. I think that MMR is associated with fever, but typically the fever actually doesn't occur the day of the vaccine. It occurs 4 days later. It's one of the vaccines that is blamed for many, many problems, and I think it has gotten the worst press because of certain bad publicity by anti-vaccine folks. In fact, articles that were written about the association or the potential association of measles and autism, those articles have been withdrawn from publication. But MMR itself can cause a fever. That's the most common reaction. Recently, the publicity has been about the combination of measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, or MMRV. And that vaccine appears to have even a little bit higher rate of fever, and with fever there has been a slight increase in febrile seizures. So basically, many people are going back to giving the MMR vaccine separately from the varicella vaccine. And perhaps Roz can speak more about that.
Yeah, and MMR vaccine I've given in practice for 30 years, and it really has relatively few side effects and is a very important vaccine. Just one note on your five-month-old, MMR vaccine is given at 12 months because it's one of those vaccines that a baby's immunity from their parents interferes with the immunity of the vaccine until about 12 months of age. The one caveat is if you travel, your child should get an MMR vaccine starting as early as 6 months of age. But as Dr. Englund mentioned, MMR in 1998, Dr. Wakefield alleged an association of MMR with autism based on a study of 12 children. That was subsequently found to be fraudulent and that he had been paid to do. And subsequently, studies on over 27 million children in various forms and reviews by a number of countries, including the United States, Sweden, and Finland, and others, have failed to see any association between MMR and autism. That's probably what you may have heard about the alleged association. But thank you for bringing that up.
I'm always, frankly, personally fascinated about how we all go about addressing risk. I mean, as a physician, we get asked about what's the risk of this every day. And a number of times I've made the comment on the program that it's not just the risk of the vaccine, it's not the risk of taking the antibiotic, it's not the risk of the surgery to see, or a biopsy if you see if you have prostate cancer. It's the risk of not doing it needs to be considered in balance mm-hmm. with the risk of doing things. And I think we could do a better job of helping people understand that, because it turns out that when you really study how humans think, we don't understand risk very well. Mm-hmm. And we're asking people every day to make these decisions. And we hear lots of information that is not substantiated, which often weighs our risk much, much, our feelings about what the risk is much greater. We know, and again, you guys correct me, there's been several recent, or at least one big recent independent evaluation, not the medical community, looking at risks of vaccines. And the fact is, there's very little that is not known. There is always going to be some risk, serious risk to the vaccines that we give in a traditional way right now. Is that also true to say?
Yes, the Institute of Medicine has conducted several reviews, one just of the issue surrounding vaccines and autism, and another of general risk. And they have, as you mentioned, found no association of autism vaccines, and also in separate reviews have found that there are side effects from vaccines, but they tend to be temporary and long-term or serious vaccine reactions are very rare. Every doctor should and provider should outline those potential risks for parents, and parents should be informed. And Jen, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think the issue is that many people hear about people who may have had, people who've had children who may have had a reaction to a vaccine. And when I say may, I think it's very important to say may, because in fact we're finding out that many of these children who actually have been awarded funds from lawsuits actually have had genetic changes that indicate that the vaccine had nothing to do with it. That there's an increase in evidence that many of the problems that were associated with vaccines actually weren't. But nonetheless, as we move forward, we have to establish what the true risks are, and the risks are big. And I would just add, one risk is if I had a six-month-old baby and I was going to France, I would get the measles vaccine for my baby. That, even though you'd think France, that's a good country and that's developed and has good hospitals, well, they still have measles. And Switzerland is now worse. I think the rate in Switzerland is even higher. So you have to put it in the context of where are you, what is your risk of getting the disease, and if your child gets the disease, what is the risk of that disease doing harm?
And I think we need to do a better job. It's if you have the absence of disease and absence of talk about the risk of disease, then it's very easy for parents to be worried about vaccines and their potential side effects, which are real. That's something that they can see, anticipate when they go in to receive vaccines, but they don't see the impact of the diseases that are prevented, like Hib meningitis. One of the strongest messages for vaccines I heard from a health care provider in a village who said, "Dr. Singleton, when children come into my clinic, I tell them my child died of meningitis the year before the vaccine was licensed." And I think we do have to remind people in the absence of vaccine preventable disease that there's still risk. Unfortunately, in Alaska, we actually have not seen any measles since 2000. However, just over the weekend, we had a warning. There was a case of measles identified on a cruise ship in a cruise ship staff member. There was no contact with Alaskans, and from the information we have, there's no danger of measles from that incidence to Alaskans. Based on the report. However, it's just a reminder of how close measles can be right now.
Dr. England, I'm a young mother, and I'm coming to you, and you're recommending she get her children get the chickenpox vaccine. And she says, "Look, chickenpox is a mild illness. Nothing ever happens to anybody with chickenpox. I grew up, I had chickenpox. My sisters had chickenpox. My brother had chickenpox. My mother had chickenpox. I've never seen anybody have a problem with chickenpox. Why are we giving chickenpox vaccine?"
I think it's true that each individual person may not have seen problems with chickenpox, but since I see hundreds and thousands of kids with chickenpox, I can tell you that I've seen severe and even fatal cases of chickenpox. So that's true. Many cases, most cases, 99% of cases of chickenpox are not bad. But there is, you know, somewhere around 1% of cases that are really bad, and they can be two forms. One is a disseminated hemorrhagic form of chickenpox, which often affects older kids, and it's just awful. I just can't get into descriptions, but basically they just start bleeding and you can't control it. It's a very terrible disease. And second and more commonly is a bacterial infection, a little strep or staph infection of chickenpox that can make kids really sick and put them again in the ICU and sometimes needing help breathing. Most of those we do better with saving. So the answer is, yeah, the odds are pretty good. The odds are pretty good. If you don't get a chickenpox vaccine, most likely your child will be fine. And perhaps we could use the analogy that we've been talking about earlier. It's also true, most likely, if you don't wear a bicycle helmet, most likely you won't fall off and hit your head and break your skull, most likely. But most of us don't think that's good enough. We think it's very important to protect our kids to the best of our ability. And you know, the question is how much risk are we willing to take? Are you willing to take? That's what the question is. I am a physician that sees these kids in the ICU, and I'm often the one that has to tell parents that their child isn't going to make it. I myself am not willing to take any of that risk with my own children.
a newer vaccine. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes. This has gone very, very fast, and I'm going to take my editorial prerogative. I want to talk about human papillomavirus, the HPV, sometimes known as the Gardasil, which is the trade name. I think it's an important vaccine. It seems like it's another vaccine where we're getting a lot of resistance from families. So I've got my a 12-year-old girl in the office, and you're telling me we want to give her a vaccine against a sexually transmitted disease. How come? What's the rationale for this?
I think the rationale is similar to the bicycle helmet. Girls have a very good response to HPV vaccine, which should prevent a substantial amount of cervical cancer that causes nearly 5,000 deaths a year. So the response is good. The vaccine appears to have long-lasting immunity. And when you want to give the vaccine before there's any sexual contact. So it's really about preventing disease for the future.
So Jen, that's why the young girls and the young boys are recommended to get this. And the other thing I understand is that these are wart fire. These are viruses that cause warts, and everybody knows they've seen a lot of warts. And so the evidence is they're very transmittable. And so once sexual activity begins, the likelihood of being exposed increases pretty significantly.
Yes. And Jen, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I think it's really important that the kids who get it when they're 12 and 13 have much better immune responses than those who get it when they're 16 or 17. Hmm. So that's one big reason. So we really want to give it younger. That's number one. Number two, it really should be considered to be an anti-cancer vaccine. Right. We know now that the 4 and soon to be potentially 9 different types of viruses in this vaccine really prevent cancer, and we're finding more and more evidence that the cancer is not just vaginal cancer or penile cancer, but there's all kinds of other cancers, including head and neck cancer, that seem to be a huge problem. And the fatal cases are high in the United States, tens of thousands of people, 5,000 cases for the cervical cancer, but more than, you know, 4 times as much if you count all the other types of cancer that may be related to these viruses.
We're in our last couple of minutes, and I'm going to just do what I usually do and ask you all to tell us what you want. What's the message that we want to leave people? We're not going to remember all the statistics. Tell us what's the bottom line here, Roz.
Vaccines are not completely without side effects. However, vaccines are one of the most important ways to protect ourselves individually, our children, and our communities against devastating infectious diseases. And we're unfortunately seeing increases in vaccine-preventable diseases where there's decrease in rates.
Dr. England, you have any comments?
Yeah, all this was great. I think the take-home message should be vaccines work. Vaccines are important. If you have questions, you should be discussing this with your doctor or healthcare professional and not necessarily relying on websites that you don't know how good they are. And if you don't get a response from a doctor, you might need to go to another healthcare professional, because it's important to get educated, but it's important to provide your child or your family members and yourself with the best possible medical care and medical prevention available.
Wow, thanks very much. I think it's been a useful hour. I've learned a couple of things, and I'm sure the listeners have as well. Roz, thanks very much. Dr. Singleton, for being here. And Dr. England, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
So my thanks to today's guests, Dr. Roz Singleton of Anchorage and Dr. Janet England, a pediatric infectious disease expert at the University of Washington, Seattle Children's. If you'd like to continue this conversation on childhood immunizations, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org on the internet. Line 1 returns next Monday, September 22nd. Our guest is health science and technology journalist Jane Stevens. And what we're going to be discussing is the recent research on the consequences of adverse experiences, particularly in early childhood, on children for the rest of their lives. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.